seats to find out the results of what ended up being one of the most politically tumultuous wars or conflicts of the 20th century. Now, many of the youngsters here today will not remember the June 67 war that has later been called the Six-Day War. But for those of us who are old enough, we recall the images in black and white that were on our TV in the evenings of the tanks rolling across the deserts, of airplanes blown up on different airports or different military airports, of the Jews celebrating at the Wailing Wall, emotionally jumping up and down, and the Orthodox Jews praying at the Wailing Wall they had been kept away from for 40 years, and the utter humiliation of the combined forces of Syria, Egypt, and Jordan. When all the dust settled, the size of the little nation of Israel that had been not an unknown nation, but certainly not a military power, the size of that nation had quadrupled, and their almost indefensible borders that were left after the 1948 War of Independence were extended and straightened to where they could actually defend their country. But for those who can remember, the 1967 war really began in the spring of June, or the spring of 1967, with a war of words. President of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser, who resigned after the humiliating defeat, said before the war, "We aim at the destruction of the State of Israel. The immediate aim is the perfection of Arab military might, and our national aim is the eradication of Israel." The military commander of Syria, a man named Hafez Assad, later became the premier, said, "Our forces are now entirely ready not only to repulse the aggression, but to initiate the act of liberation itself and to explode the Zionist presence in the Arab homeland. The Syrian army, with its finger on the trigger, is united. I, as military man, believe the time has come to begin a battle of annihilation." During these months, as always, there were many efforts to create peace. The major nations of the earth, France, America, even some with the Soviet Union, but also Britain, became involved with various letters and diplomatic efforts trying to forestall what looked like the inevitable conflict. Prime Minister of Israel was Levi Eshkol. He said, "Israel's Arab neighbors made clear their intentions to attack Israel. He sent letters to the various groups asking for peace, asking for negotiations. But there was continuous Syrian shelling from the Golan Heights on the towns of Israel in the north. There were terrorist attacks across the Gaza Strip into southern Israel and also from Lebanon." By May of 1967, along the 1948 armistice lines, which had simply been the lines drawn after the battles were over in 1948 after a five-month-long battle of survival for the new nation of Israel that began with the expiration of the Palestinian mandate and the exodus of the British troops in 1948, those lines were lined with Arab armies from seven different nations. Israel faced 465,000 troops, 2,880 enemy tanks, 810 modern aircraft, most furnished by the Soviet Union. The armies of Kuwait, Algeria, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq added troops to the massive armies of Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. The war was really initiated on about the 28th of May, when Egypt announced the closure of the Straits of Tiran, which are at the very choke point coming down from the Red Sea so that the Israelis could not take their ships from the port of Eilat and conduct international trade. When President Nasser announced the closure of the Tiran states and the naval blockade, the President of the United States was a man named Lyndon Johnson. And he said, "If a single act of folly was more responsible for this explosion than any, it was the arbitrary and dangerous announced decision that the Strait of Tiran would be closed. The right of innocent maritime passage needs to be reserved for all nations." It was recognized as an act of war. Britain and France acknowledged that Egypt had declared war, or at least had begun war, on Israel. Concurrent with that, President Nasser of Egypt expelled all United Nations peacekeeping troops from the area. most of which were stationed in the Sinai Peninsula. Since the Israelis realized that the war would be won in the air, they took preemptive strikes on June the 5th. Early that morning, they launched all of their aircraft, and they attacked on the ground the combined armies, or the combined air forces, of Egypt and Syria, annihilating as much as 80% of the combat-ready aircraft of both of those countries, losing only about 6 of their own planes. Immediately, the Arabs attacked, especially down in Egypt. An army of 300,000 Egyptians came across the border and took on in the Negev Desert. They were met by a man we've all come to know about, a man named Ariel Sharon, commanded most of the southern command for the Israelis. The central command and northern commands were a man named Moshe Dayan. And if you've read their autobiographies, you know about their exploits during this time. Moshe Dayan actually lost his eye during the War of Independence in 1948, but he was the Israeli defense minister, one of the chief generals during the 1967 war. After a couple days, the Syrians attacked, or the second day, the Syrians attacked, and the Israelis were fighting on two fronts. For those of us who were Americans watching on television, we didn't have satellite feeds back then. We didn't have, you know, color sort of, like we're already there. What they did was they took black and white reels on 16-millimeter film, and those were sent on airplanes back to New York where they were developed, and they would show them the next night on the evening news. So the reels, the footage that was seen on the evening news, whether it was Walter Cronkite or one of the other, Roger Mudd, one of the other evening news hours, it was basically 24-hour footage. It was not real in-time satellite feeds like we have today. It was basically 24-hour old black and white footage. I think it was black and white because it was able to be developed much more quickly than color. The processes for developing color film at that time took about 4 days, and black and white was more like 10 hours, so they were able to develop the black and white films, get them printed, and show them on the evening news. But if you are as old as me or older, because I was a youngster back then, obviously, and I saw lots of hair. In fact, I was delivering papers. I remember delivering papers and reading the events of the war. We remember the bright images on black and white TV in the evenings. Remember the Jews celebrating at the Wailing Wall. In fact, I remember the little guys in the black hats and the braids, you know, bouncing back and forth as they prayed in front of the Wailing Wall, the Orthodox Jews. And the big celebrations and the dancing in the streets. It wasn't just in Israel that took place. It was also in places as far-flung as the Jewish colony in Hong Kong, in Australia, in Iran, in fact, all around the world. But I'm getting ahead of the story. After 3 days of fighting, the Israelis simply didn't put out any news announcements. They just simply said the war is continuing. The Egyptians and the Syrians announced they were winning, even though that was exactly the opposite of what was going on. And by the time you added up the number of enemy soldiers they said they had killed and airplanes they had destroyed, it was several times the size of the Israeli army. At that point, King Hussein was not in the war. Jordan was not a combatant until the fourth day of the war. And in fact, they still held on to the West Bank and all of West Jerusalem and the old part of Jerusalem, especially the Temple Mount. But after 4 days of losing, President Nasser of Egypt sent a letter to King Hussein. This was the second letter he received. The first letter that King Hussein of Jordan received was from Levi Eshkol of Israel. It said, quote, "We are engaged in defensive fighting in the Egyptian sector. We shall not engage ourselves in any action against Jordan unless Jordan attacks us. Should Jordan attack Israel, we shall go against her with all of our might." So the Israelis warned King Hussein to stay out of the war. The King Hussein received a message from President Nasser of Egypt saying the Egyptian army was on the verge of taking Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, that if Jordan did not want to completely miss out on occupying any of the lands, they would need to get into battle very quickly. So the Jordanians believed this false report from President Nasser of Egypt, and they then started shelling Tel Aviv with their artillery. They were able to reach with their artillery most of the airfields in Israel. They attacked the towns of Netanya and Kfar Saba. They also shelled mortar shells on Israeli hospitals in Jerusalem and in the Tel Aviv area. All told, because of the Jordanian artillery barrage, 20 Israelis died and 1,000 were wounded. However, Moshe Dayan and his group were ready. They pretty much had a few hours' notice that it might happen. And they, in a hand-to-hand combat and house-to-house combat, retook West Jerusalem, the old city of Jerusalem, the Jewish quarter, and the troops just kept going until they reached Jericho and the Jordan River and through the Jordanian army all the way back across what is today called the West Bank. When the dust settled, of course, the little nation of Israel became a huge political power. Its military was recognized worldwide as being a serious military power. In fact, today it is listed as the second most powerful military in the world, United States being first and Israel being second. And the third nation is listed, I'm not sure if it's Russia or Britain, but it's probably Russia. But a few years later, there was another war in 1974, also before many of you were born. In the 1974 war, which was called the Yom Kippur War because it was started by the Egyptians on the day of Yom Kippur, when they were losing, they appealed to Russia for help. And the Russians were planning then an invasion of Israel from the north, come down across Turkey and Iraq in that way. And the Israeli generals refused. They said, if we attack Israel, they will beat us, because they knew that the Israeli army would actually be able to defeat the Russians. As soon as the Russians left their homeland and sent their airplanes in the air, they said, they'll shoot us all down, and we will have no air support, and any ships we send in will be sunk. And so, other than using nuclear weapons, the Russians realized they were beaten before they started. And so, they did not attack Israel in 1973 during the Yom Kippur War. Since the war of 1967, the Six-Day War, the Middle East has not seen peace. There have been additional wars, intifadas, attacks into Lebanon several times. And in fact, most of those wars, the Israelis have simply fought to a standstill. We have almost daily reoccurrences of attacks on the West Bank, of rocket attacks that come down from places like Gaza onto Ashkelon. Certainly something that has not caused peace. But the American Bible scholars, the American evangelical religionists that watch events in the Middle East, often quote the 1967 war. And this last week, with the 40th anniversary of that war, I think everybody understands there's a certain amount of biblical significance to the number 40. There have been a number of programs, a number of scholars, and I thought it was worthwhile to review at least what some of the concepts they discuss are about. First, I want to turn over to Zephaniah chapter 2. As we look at not only what has happened in the Middle East in the last 100 years and the establishing of a physical nation made up primarily of descendants of Judah, not descendants of Israel. These Israelites primarily, of course, live other places. But those descendants of Judah, who today make up the physical nation of Israel, when the modern-day evangelicals and others look in the Bible to try to discern what is happening prophecy-wise, one of the first scriptures they turn to is here in Zephaniah chapter 2. And I want to begin down, let's say, about verse 4 of Zephaniah chapter 2. This prophecy is right after the day of the Lord. The book of Zephaniah, obviously, is very much an end-time book concerning its subject. It says, Gaza shall be forsaken and Ashkelon desolate. Now, Gaza we hear about quite often. I've never been there. I've driven by it. It's a very highly populated place, a lot of high-rise apartment ghettos, basically. Very filthy place in many ways. But Gaza back then was simply a city on one of the main trade routes down to the south on the road down to Egypt. It was a port city very close to the ocean. North of there is Ashkelon. It says, Gaza shall be forsaken and Ashkelon desolate. Ashkelon, of course, was a center of Canaanite worship. A lot of temples there to Dagon and various Canaanite gods. If you go there today, you can go out and swim in a very beautiful beach on the ocean, and there are ruins, there are columns and all sorts of leftovers of all these pagan temples that were built on the beach there at Ashkelon. And I swam there one time and remember all these columns and all these things, little statues just sitting there in the sand, so you wonder, why does somebody dig these up and try to figure out what they were? And maybe they have since then. But Ashkelon is north of Gaza and today receives some of these homemade rockets that are fired from time to time that you hear about in the news. They shall drive Ashdod out at noonday. So even north now, north of Ashkelon is Ashdod. And Ekron, another one of the centers of the Philistine worship of pagan gods, shall be uprooted. Verse 5 says, "Woe to the inhabitants of the seacoast, the nation of Kerethites, the word of the Lord is against you, O Canaan, land of the Philistines. I will destroy you, so there shall be no inhabitant." So much of this prophecy concerns Canaanites, Philistines, who live there on the coast. It says in verse 6, "The seacoast shall be pastures, with shelters for shepherds and folds for flocks." Notice verse 7. In fact, verse 7 is the key scripture that many of the in the evangelical world believe was fulfilled in 1948 when the nation of Jews, especially the refugee Jews out of Europe, forged that nation on the coastline there called Israel. Verse 7 says, "The coast shall be for the remnant of the house of Judah." And whether that has been fulfilled in the 1948 establishing of the nation of Israel under David Ben-Gurion, we really don't know, but certainly many Bible prophecies or Bible prophets, Bible scholars, interpreters, point to it and say, absolutely for certainty, this is proof that we are in the end time because verse 7 has been fulfilled before our eyes, and it's only a matter of time before Jesus Christ returns. It says, "They shall feed their flocks there. In the houses of Ashkelon they shall lie down in the evening." So he's talking, you know, the prophecy is about a sort of a peaceful setting for these remnant of the house of Judah, these Jews, who are living on the coast. "For the Lord their God will intervene for them and return their captives." Now much of the rest of the chapter, of course, is about Moab, Ammon, some of the other nations, Ethiopia, many of the historical enemies of Israel, and what God says he's going to do about them, basically either punishing them or making them have a relationship with Israel that is healed and that they basically are able to become peaceable neighbors. So that verse is very important, Zephaniah chapter 2 and verse 7. If you're listening to any sort of a program on prophecy and they say, well, the Bible specifically prophesied that the nation, the Jews would be living there in Israel when Christ returns, this is basically the verse they are talking about. Now, the 1967 war is believed to have fulfilled a couple conditions that are given to us in the book of Daniel. Let's go to Daniel chapter 11. Daniel 11, obviously, is a prophecy about the king of the north, the king of the south. It's a prophecy many years earlier concerning the Antiochus Epiphanes, the abomination of desolation. It's a very, very long prophecy concerning the time that it covers. Long, just a number of verses, too. It's a very long prophecy, number of verses, 45. But it does end up, obviously, with the return of Christ and the establishing of the beast power before that in Jerusalem. So in Daniel chapter 11, let's begin in verse 31. It says, "Forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress, and they shall take away the daily." Of course, the word sacrifices is there, but it's in italics. The original Hebrew is the word for continual or ongoing worship. So they'll take away the ongoing worship or continuing worshiping of God, and there place the abomination of desolation. So when the people look at this verse, there are three events in history that are supposedly fulfillments of this, and very likely they are correct. The first one, of course, was in 167 B.C., when Antiochus Epiphanes took Jerusalem, and he was upset with the Jews, so he brought in a statue of Jupiter Olympus, a Greek god, and he placed it in the sanctuary of the temple, and he sacrificed swine, and he scattered some of the swine blood and water from the boiled swine meat around the temple area, defiling it. And so that historically was a taking away of the daily sacrifice that had been going on, and a defiling of or abominating of the temple. Now, the second time, of course, was when the Romans took Jerusalem in 70 AD under the Roman Emperor Titus. Now, if you look at both of these events, they are a type of what the beast is going to do when he takes Jerusalem the next time. But is the 167 BC example a better example than the one in 70 AD, or is the one in 70 AD a little better example of what might happen during the third fulfillment? Well, the record we have for the Romans taking the Temple Mount in 70 AD comes from the writer Josephus, the ancient Jewish historical writer from the first and second century. And he has a fairly detailed account, not only of the surrounding of the city of Jerusalem, and its first, of course, was surrounded in 68 AD by Vespasian, And then, of course, Nero died, and Vespasian wanted to be emperor, so he got on a boat and went back to Rome and left off the armies. The armies left Jerusalem. Tradition, of course, and some records have the church fleeing during that six month of freedom that the city of Jerusalem had, and the church fled to a place called Pella over in what is today Jordan. But Vespasian arrived back in Rome, and the year 69 AD was the year of four emperors. When they're actually late 68, early 69, Galba and several others all became emperor, and they kind of fought each other, and eventually Vespasian did become the emperor. He assigned his son Titus to then finish the campaign against the Jews and to quiet that very tumultuous and very difficult region of the Roman Empire that they called Palestina or Palestine. So Titus then was the son of the emperor, and given the way Romans were doing things, the soldiers realized that Titus would probably someday become emperor because they passed on the emperorship to their son. And once he was emperor, he would be called a god. They had deified Augustus after his death, called him a superior god. They had made temples to him. They had deified Tiberius even while he was still yet alive, and had built temples to him, even though you have to scratch your head and wonder why Tiberius, the way he lived, was certainly an odd duck. And certainly they had not deified Nero because he was so pathetic, but you know, Claudius and others, as soon as they died, the Roman emperor was declared a god by the Senate and then worshipped, and they had various feast days to them. That practice comes down to us today in the Catholic honoring of saints, that after a person is dead, they can then declare this person a saint, and they have special days on the calendar to honor the saints. The problem was there were only about 12 to 15 Roman emperors that were deified, so there's plenty of space on the calendar, but there were so many Catholic saints deified that there wasn't any more space on the calendar, so they started All Saints Day, which came down to us as All Saints Eve or Halloween. So when you are trick-or-treating, I guess you're sort of imitating the ancient Roman emperors going around at night as they came back to bother people in Rome. Now, having said all of that, and it's important to understand the background, the Romans finally, after a year and a half siege, took Jerusalem under Titus. The Jews did not give any inch easily. They killed many Roman soldiers. They tricked them often. They would pretend being dead, let them into traps. And the Romans took the city inch by inch in 70 AD in the early summer. In fact, the city fell on the 9th of Ab, and the temple was burnt on the 10th of Ab, the same day it was taken and burnt, and same day of the calendar as it was in 586 under Nebuchadnezzar. When the city fell on the 10th of Ab, Titus went into the temple itself. And Titus thought the building so beautiful that he ordered the fires put out. He tried to get his Roman soldiers to stop the burning of the temple area, the temple complex. He wanted to save that building because he thought it was very beautiful and could be used by Rome. But the temple was full of vast quantities of gold, big pots of gold. They had been keeping offerings. The Pharisees had for many, many generations. Much of all the furniture and the vessels of the temple, and there were hundreds and hundreds of them, were made of pure gold or silver. So the soldiers began to loot. The fire was not put out, and the main beams of the temple collapsed. The next day, Titus, disappointed that the temple had not been spared, although the platforms were still there and the basic outside walls, he had the leaders of his army come in. I'll read you what Josephus says they did. It says, "Now the Romans, upon the flight of the seditious into the city, and upon the burning of the holy house itself, and of all the buildings round about it, brought their ensigns to the temple." So each of the battalions or the units of the Roman army had their, you know, had a pole, had a big flag on it that had their name of their group. Even today we have our military divided up into various companies and battalions and other things. So they know what unit they belong to. So they brought their ensigns to the temple and set them over against the eastern gate. So they faced the rising sun. And it said, "There they did then offer sacrifices to them." So they offered sacrifices essentially to themselves. Maybe they were thanking the Roman gods for their victory over the Jews finally. It said, "They also there acclaimed Titus as a god. They called him Titus Imperator with the greatest acclamations of joy. So if you think about it, they went into the temple where Jesus Christ had walked, and they set up all of their Roman standards on the eastern side facing the Mount of Olives, and they then had Titus come in, and they declared him to be a god. So they're declaring a human being to be a god in God's temple, so it's obvious blasphemy. But it may be very similar to what might happen again in the future. If you read Revelation 17, other places where the beast does all these miracles, and people then assume this must be somehow the real Christ, or must be the real God here protecting us from the one coming. However it works out, the concept that people will then acclaim this person as a god seems to fulfill the abomination desolation prophecy even more directly, very likely, than the original account back in 167 BC under the Greeks. I want to go over right now to Zechariah, where we were, just back a little bit, Zechariah chapter 2, because the prelude to this chapter concerning end time events that many look at and say, well, this is a prophecy about the Israelites or the Jews establishing their nation on the seacoast before Christ returns. And then in Daniel, where we have these prophecies about the sacrifice being taken away, and they, of course, interpret that as being the Jews today are going to go up on the Dome of the Rock and tear it down, and they're going to build a temple and start doing sacrifices. And then when that's taken away, then that means Christ is going to return. It's interesting, if you read Moshe Dayan's autobiography, when his soldiers took the western parts of Jerusalem, eastern Jerusalem, and took the Temple Mount, the bulldozers were ready. The Jewish soldiers were very enthusiastic about getting out their bulldozers and destroying the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque and clearing off the Temple Mount area, Mount Moriah or Mount Zion, whatever you want to call it, so they could rebuild the temple and they could have their own worship. Now, Moshe Dayan knew, and so did Levi Eshkol, that if they sent in bulldozers and destroyed the third most holy shrine of Islam, that they could be facing something far worse than what they had just faced. Now, they knew that nations that are highly Muslim, places like Iran, Iraq, Indonesia, the largest Muslim nation on the face of the earth, all the nations in North Africa, that they would all declare war on Israel. And in fact, they might have much more to deal with than they possibly could deal with successfully. So Mr. Dayan, General Dayan, and the others with him allowed an Arab group of Muslims to continue ownership and operations of the Temple Mount. And to this day, that I think it's called the Mukta or something of Jerusalem, they are still the civil authority on the Temple Mount and the Al-Aqsa Mosque area. So there has not been any rebuilding of any physical temple, and there has not been any reestablishing of any sacrifices in Jerusalem. I think most of you that have heard me speak in the past know that I think that's basically a ruse, that's very likely not going to happen that way, that what's taken out of the way is the continuing worship of God, and which is prophesied for us not only in there, other places like Revelation 3, where the church is taken out of the way to a place of safety, and there is then a famine of the word for 3 or 3.5 years. But having said that, many Americans today, when they look at June 1967, they believe that cleared the way for the prophecies in Daniel 11 and Daniel 12 to be finished. And there are people over there, and you see stuff about it in the internet all, you know, occasionally. There are various Jewish groups that want to charge up to the Temple Mount at 11 o'clock at night and set up some sort of a temporary little altar and start killing innocent animals and irritating the rest of the world. Well, that may happen and it may not happen. I really doubt if it's going to. Certainly if it does, it will not be a rebuilding of any kind of a temple and a reestablishing of any sort of a sacrificial system like they had back in the first century. Certainly that just simply does not seem possible given today's weakness in the military area in Israel and other things that are taking place. So Americans, though, if you look at a lot of the religious community, they still look back at the events of 40 years ago today as paving the way for the return of Jesus Christ. Now in Zechariah chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, I'm sorry, Zephaniah chapter 2, I was in the wrong book. They're spelled kind of similar, but with my bad eyes, I can't see them all that well. Okay, Zephaniah chapter 2, in verse 1. This is right before the other prophecies on the coast that we read down in verse 7. Gather yourselves together, yes, gather together, O the undesired nation. So the nation of Israel he's talking about was a desired and beloved nation, but now it is an immoral nation. And God has said, I don't desire you anymore because you have turned against me. You are immoral, you are corrupt, your leaders are dishonest and corrupt. He says, before the decree is issued or the day passes like chaff, before the Lord's fierce anger comes upon you, before this time of punishment comes upon the earth, before this tribulation hits, before the day of the Lord's anger comes upon you, there's a warning. You say, look, there's a very terrible time coming. But he says in verse 3, seek the Lord, all you meek of the earth, who have upheld his justice. There's a time of trouble coming, he said. You've got a little window of opportunity here to seek the Lord, all you meek of the earth, who have upheld his justice. In other words, who keep his laws and try to live a righteous life. Seek righteousness, seek humility, and it may be that you will be hidden in the day of the Lord's anger. The warning that we have in Zephaniah right before the prophecies concerning Gaza and Ashkelon and Canaan and Philistia and the nation of Judah on the coast really tells us that there's a warning for us individually to seek God with all of our heart, to uphold his justice, to seek righteousness and humility. And it may be that we might be saved or spared, hidden by God in the day of the Lord's anger. Very similar to other prophecies in the Bible. Let's go over to Revelation chapter 7. Revelation chapter 7, where we have a pause in the march of events so that God's people can be sealed and that God can then protect them during this time of coming wrath. Very similar in its message and application to what we have back in Zephaniah chapter 2. So Revelation chapter 7, verse 1 says, after these things I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, north, south, east, and west, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, on the sea, or on any tree. I saw another angel ascending from the east. So God is holding up events here. This angel ascends from the east, having the seal of the living God. So he has a seal. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it is granted to harm the earth and the sea. So these angels are preparing this wrath from God. The angel carries this seal from God and says, don't do that yet. He says, don't harm the earth, the sea, or the trees till we have sealed the servants of God in their foreheads. Now this is after chapter 6, obviously, where some of the earlier sealed documents are opened. And we find a lot of tribulation. We find some of the events that Christ mentioned in Matthew 24 and other places happening. But in this case, time stands still for a few minutes, or events stand still, while the people of God have their heads sealed, or a seal placed upon their foreheads, so that they would not be harmed. Now, this word seal is the Greek word spharagis. That's actually spelled S-P-H-R-A-G-I-S. It occurs in the Bible a number of times, but the word seal tells us something, or the other places it's used, tells us something about what it really means. What does it mean when this angel, you know, stamps this seal on the foreheads of God's people, and then somehow that prevents them from being harmed? Well, let's look over to 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 19, where the seal is mentioned earlier. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 19. We are told here what the seal of God is. Revelation doesn't tell us in detail. This gives us a lot more information. In 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 19, Paul says very plainly, nevertheless, the solid foundation of God stands. Now before that, he's talking about people not striving about words and not arguing. Timothy presenting himself as a diligent worker to God that does not need to be ashamed, rightly understanding God's truth. He warns about some false teachers named Hymenaeus and Philetus. Then he says, the solid foundation of God stands and has this seal. So this is the seal of God. The Lord knows those who are his. Remember that if we have God's Spirit, he knows us. He knows those who are his. And let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity. So those who have the seal of God have His Spirit. Jesus Christ said, "My sheep know My voice." In Romans it says, if we don't have God's Spirit, we are none of His, but if we do, we are adopted sons into His family. So the Lord knows those who are His, and those who are His then depart from iniquity. In other words, they quit sinning. They quit breaking God's laws. So the seal is to depart from iniquity. The seal is to have God's Spirit and be known by Him. Verse 20. In a great house there are not only vessels of gold and silver, but also of wood and clay. Some for honor and some for dishonor. Now this can be a kind of a puzzling verse. Is the great house, say, well, it's a big church, and there's a lot of people going to that church, and some have character of gold and silver, but some only think they have character. They really have wood and clay, and when the fiery trial comes, they're going to be disappeared. Maybe it means in a nation. In a nation of people, there are some who have gold and silver as character, and some who are wood and clay. You know, we really don't know. We really don't know exactly what this means. I do think it also means that in an individual, in each one of us, there are character traits of gold and silver, but we also have faults typified by wood and clay that we must be cleansed of. Because he says in verse 21, if anyone therefore cleanses himself of the latter, the items of dishonor, then he will be a vessel for honor, sanctified and useful for the master, prepared for every good work. So we are in the process of purging ourselves from essentially sinful activities. Even lists some here, youthful lusts, other things, foolish and ignorant disputes, verse 23. He says, instead pursue good things, you know, the gold, the silver, righteousness, faith, love, peace, with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. So the warning's pretty solid, and the description of this seal that God's servants have in Revelation chapter 7 is that they have the Spirit of God, and they are trying to overcome iniquity. They don't like iniquity. They depart from sin or unrighteousness. Now let's go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 10. We learn something else about the seal, something else about how it applies in our lives, that it really is the symbol of God's presence. As it was the symbol of God's presence in the nation of Israel, the Spirit of God is now the symbol of God's presence in our life, in us as individuals. 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 10 says, according to the grace of God, which was given to me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another builds on it. But let each one take heed how he builds upon it. So he said, look, I taught you the truth. I gave you the basic tenets to achieve God's kingdom, and another builds upon it. But everybody has to take heed how they build upon the truth that they've been taught. It says, for no other foundation can anyone lay except that which is laid, that is, Jesus Christ. Now, obviously, people can teach false doctrines. What he's saying is nobody can lay upon his foundation because he taught the foundation of Jesus Christ and his teachings. He says, if anybody tries to teach something different than the testimony of Jesus Christ, he's simply wrong. Now, if anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, all three of those, God says, typify character of his people, wood, hay, and straw, those things, of course, are going to be burned up, each one's work will become clear, for the day will declare it. So, again, he's warning us that we have a little window of opportunity. We have however many years we have when God warns us there is a time coming, and at that time, it's going to be revealed if your character is gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, or straw. Each one's work will become clear, for the day will declare it. It will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test each one's work of what sort it is. Now, in our limited experience, we've seen at least one or two examples of events that have occurred with almost no warning. Nobody around that I know of predicted the attacks of September 11th, 2001. We just woke up one morning, turned on TV to watch the weather. All of a sudden, there it was, all these planes crashing into the buildings and the fire, and the world's equilibrium pretty much was turned upside down in one day. That may happen again. It may happen very quickly as we find various things happening that we simply have no control over. You know, the Israelis in 1967 captured about 150,000 Egyptian soldiers on the Sinai Peninsula. Now, the reason they were captured, they wanted to fight. They had all their equipment. They had their guns, they had their ammunition, they had their cannons and their artillery emplaced, but their leaders left. Their generals and their colonels all took off and went back to Cairo. They were what's called scaredy cats. So you had all these hundreds, thousands of units of Egyptian soldiers kind of milling around the Sinai Peninsula, not knowing what to do or where to go, and the Israelis simply surrounded them and took them prisoner. There are stories that they were surrendering even to women out in their gardens and various things. So even though you think it's going to take a long time, if the leadership of a group decides to surrender, it's pretty much over overnight. And the same was true, by the way, in France in 1940 when the Nazis attacked. The French army was actually bigger than the Nazi army, but Pétain and the other French leaders in 1940 had the spine of a chocolate éclair, as President Roosevelt once said, and they surrendered to the Nazis in less than 3 weeks, even though the army wanted to fight, but the leaders simply surrendered. Winston Churchill, by the way, didn't surrender. He said, no, we're going to fight to the last man. He eventually overcame, and the Nazis were defeated. But the lessons we learn is that a nation can fall very quickly, and our life can be turned upside down very quickly. World events can just be different one morning when we wake up. And now with modern-day technology, you know, the word spreads very, very quickly. In fact, instantaneously across the earth with the satellites and the internet technology. So we don't know what day it will be that we'll declare it, what day we'll wake up, and the character, whether it's gold, silver, stones, or if we've kind of cheated ourselves, wood, hay, and straw, becomes apparent, it will be too late. That window of opportunity that Zephaniah prophesied about, we won't be able to go back and say, oh, by the way, I want to relive the last 3 years because I sort of got myself in trouble here. Verse 15 does say, if anyone's work is burned, he will suffer loss, but he himself will be saved, yet so as through fire. Maybe referring to the Laodicean prophecy where some have soiled garments and are refined as they are brought through the fire, but many, of course, have to give their lives in order to do that. Do you not know that you are the temple of God and the Spirit of God dwells in you? The Spirit of God dwelt in the ancient temple built by Solomon and the tabernacle before that, and that was the sign that they were God's people. Our sign today is that God dwells in us. God dwells in his people, not in our building. If anyone defiles the temple of God, God will destroy him. So it is our responsibility not to defile our temple by allowing unholy things into it, by allowing sinful activities, sinful thoughts, lusts, all sorts of things that he mentions earlier. And of course, Satan is very crafty to get people to try to do that. Normally in their own wisdom and their own rational thinking, verse 18, let no one deceive himself. So he's talking about defiling the temple of God. You do it by deceiving yourself. If anyone among you seems to be wise in this age, let him become a fool that he may become wise. For the wisdom of this world, the rationalizing of sin, is foolishness with God. It is written, he catches the wise in their own craftiness. And again, the Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they are futile. So the argument is very clear that Paul is making, that the character we are building now will be tested, whether it's gold, silver, wood, hay, stubble. And we will not have a lot of time to play catch-up ball when it's done. Now let's go back to the seal. What happens to these people that have the seal of God? Let's go back to Revelation chapter 14. Revelation chapter 14, beginning in verse 1. We've already seen that the seal of God means we have his Spirit, and he knows us and we know him, and that we are departing from iniquity. It is getting away from sin, trying to live a righteous life according to God's laws and precepts. That really is the seal of God. In Revelation 14 and verse 1, as I looked and behold, a lamb was standing on Mount Zion, and with him were 144,000 having his father's name written on their forehead. So they had this seal of God typified by having their father's name written on their foreheads. Obviously the same group that's described back in Revelation chapter 7. And they have skipped out on some of the events in the intervening chapters. Verse 2, I heard a voice from heaven, like the voice of many waters, so a very powerful, very rumbling type of sound, like the voice of a loud thunder. And I heard the sound of harpists playing their harps. Now this may be where some of the, you know, Protestants or whatever believe they're going to go to heaven and play harps when they die. And they're going to go up, you know, on this cloud, learn to play harps. You know, harps are not really that exciting to play. I've never played one, but looks like they're awfully hard, and your fingernails get caught in the strings and all those things. But you know why that would be heavenly bliss, I never have figured out. But there are people in heaven playing harps. They're probably spiritual beings, and the harps probably look a little different than harps today. At any rate, we have these people who have their name on God's name on their foreheads. John hears this voice from heaven. Here's the thunderous voice. Here's the harps. They sang, as it were, a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures and the elders. Now notice, the Lamb is standing with them on the Mount of Olives, or on Mount Zion, across from the Mount of Olives. And they're singing this song that nobody could sing except these people that have this seal. Notice verse 4. These are the ones who were not defiled with women. Now, obviously, some of them were women. So what does that mean? They were not defiled with women. They are virgins. The ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These were redeemed from among men, first fruits to God and to the Lamb. Well, the women obviously referred to here would be the harlots of Babylon that typify false religion. Let's go over to Revelation chapter 17. The women this is referring to are not women who wear a dress. This is the women and her daughters, the woman and her daughters, that symbolizes false religion and all sorts of false religion. You know, false religion comes in all flavors. You can find religion that makes you feel better about yourself, promises you health and wealth while using the name of Jesus Christ. Others teach you to worship Mary or saints using the name of Jesus Christ. Others teach you to pay homage to individual men or others who have lived other lives or earlier lives using the name of Jesus Christ. Many try to teach you to break God's commandments using the name of Jesus Christ. So these harlots deceive the world, and these people that have the seal of God are those who have not been deceived by the harlots. Revelation 17 and verse 4, it says, there's a woman arrayed in purple and scarlet. It says she was adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. Now, you think about it for a minute. God calls his people, his saints, as having precious stones or being precious stones. He even talks about making up jewels and precious stones back in Revelation 2 and 3. And later he talks about the holy city Jerusalem having stones and pearls around it. So what are these gold and precious stones and pearls that this woman has arrayed on her? Now, I'll tell you my theory. This is my theory. This is not thus saith anybody but me, I suppose. I think these gold and precious stones represents kidnapped Christians over the years, deceived people. In every church era, if you go down through the seven eras of the church, both in the Old Testament and the New, the eras had to change, or a new era had to begin, because the leadership of the church became corrupt. In the Ephesian era, they began to follow Simon Magus and some of his teachings, and that era pretty much disappeared, and then the next era had to take over. And the same thing happened in the Middle Ages, where they had people who followed the Nicolaitans and others who followed after other heresies. But the sad history is that many who had assembled with God's true church over the years somehow became a part of false teaching and became a part of false ideas and false churches, certainly using some biblical terms and many using Jesus Christ's name. But they really are just people or precious stones that have been kidnapped and taken away. And this woman wears them like they are trophies. These are sort of her war history and the things she has earned over the years with her abominations and her deceit. So she has in her hand also a golden cup full of abominations. All sorts of lies, false teaching, false advice to people. And the filthiness of her fornication that she has deceived the world with. On her forehead was a name written called Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. So she's the mother of all of these harlots who are other women who are teaching false religion around the earth and of the abominations of the earth. Verse 6, I saw the woman and she was drunk with the saints, the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. And of course, then he talks to the angel, and the angel describes the beast and also who this woman was. Verse 15, he said to me, the waters which you saw are where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And so this false teaching of this great harlot and all of her harlot daughters really fills the entire earth. Now let's go back over to chapter 14. Now that we've realized, or now that we've looked and seen that the women that we are not to be defiled with concern false religion, concern teaching against God's laws, concern teaching other gods, idols of one form or another. Notice these first fruits, though, in verse 4 are described further in verse 5 as saying, in their mouth was found no deceit. They don't speak lies. They don't argue about right and wrong because they know what right is. They don't deceive people in any way. In the mouth of God's people, those who have the seal of God, there is no deceit. It says they are without fault before the throne of God. That means, of course, they're forgiven. That Jesus Christ's sacrifice has taken away their sins. And so they are without fault before the throne of God. So we have this group that doesn't speak guile and that has the seal of God. And they, of course, understand very clearly that they have the name of God written on their forehead because they want to be in His family. They have His seal, not the seal of the beast. Let's go back over for a little more information in Revelation chapter 3. Revelation 3 and verse 11. Having God's name written on our forehead is the result of overcoming. It's something that is the result of obeying God with all of our mind, all of our effort, and striving to serve Him. It is not that we just by accident wake up one morning, feel this thump on our head, and we have this, quote, seal. That's not the way it works. Revelation 3 and verse 11, behold, I am coming quickly. Jesus Christ, of course, is talking to John. He's writing it down for us. Hold fast what you have, that no man take your crown. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write on him my new name. So having God's name written on our forehead is the result of overcoming. And if we haven't been overcoming enough, then it's time that we started. It's time we got to work, analyzed our life, and said, okay, where do I need to overcome more in order to have this name and this seal imprinted on my head in the right way? Interesting, but the Bible even ceases its chronological story, talking about those who have the servants of God who have their name sealed, His name sealed on their head. Let's go over to Revelation chapter 22. Revelation chapter 22. It's really the last chapter in the Bible, but the storyline pretty much ends in verse 5. The last verses, 6 through 20 or 21, are kind of a summary of what John has been writing, final salutations and warnings and admonishments to us all to obey these words, not to add to them, not to take away from them. So Revelation chapter 22, in verse 1, he showed me the pure river of the water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and of the Lamb. So the spring of beautiful clear water just wells out of the ground below the throne of God and of the Lamb. In the middle of its street, and on either side of the river, there's a tree of life, which bore 12 fruits, each tree yielding its fruit every month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. So now the tree of life is available to everyone, and they're able to partake of that and receive the healing of all the scars, all the problems that have been over the years, but the healing of spiritual misunderstanding. Verse 3, there's no more curse, no more curse from Adam and Eve, no more evils being done, no more murders, no more envy, no more adultery, no more of the curses from Adam and Eve. But the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it. His servants shall see him. So the servants will see God. He's on his throne. Jesus Christ is on his right hand. His servants are there. They shall see his face, and his name shall be on their foreheads. So the final result of having the seal of God is to be at some point in the New Jerusalem, dwelling with God the Father and God the Son. Those people have their name on their foreheads, his name on their foreheads. There shall be no night there. They need no lamp nor light of the sun, for the Lord God gives them light, and they shall reign forever and ever. Very powerful prophecy for all of us. But if God has His mark, if He has His name to be sealed on our foreheads, we also know that Satan the devil has his mark because he counterfeits everything God does. So let's take a minute just to look at Satan's mark and to make sure we are able to avoid that. Let's go back first to Revelation chapter 13. Revelation chapter 13. You know, as people look at the events in the Middle East and make note of anniversaries of wars and other events, and then urgently say, well, you know, Bible prophecy is about to be fulfilled, Christ is going to return, you know, there's some truth in that. Certainly there is. But what they're looking for often is a mirage on the horizon that never materializes. Things like the rapture. So many millions have their hearts set on waiting for the rapture, an event that will never occur, and they'll be taken by surprise when the real events do occur. Maybe one reason why they will be so easily sucked into the system of the beast, because they're waiting for a rapture that's already not going to happen, and they think the beast won't be here until after it does. In Revelation chapter 13, verse 1 says, I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea. He has 7 heads and 10 horns. On his horns, 10 crowns. On his heads, a blasphemous name. So we have this beast that comes out of the sea, and of course the beast then has all the attributes of the Roman Empire, the fourth world ruling government. Then in verse 7, it was granted to him to make war with the saints and overcome them. And authority was given to him over every tribe and every nation and tongue. All who dwell on the earth will worship him whose names have not been written in the book of the Lamb, book of life of the Lamb, who was slain from the foundation of the world. So this beast here is on the scene. Down in verse 11, I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. He had 2 horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. So we have a resurrected beast. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell on it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. So we have this religious beast on the scene, religious animal, so to speak, performing all these miracles to get people to worship the civil government, the resurrected Roman Empire. Notice verse 13, he performs great signs. So he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. So he does a lot of magic things, and people are really taken in by it. Verse 14, he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast. So he's basically standing there in front of the beast doing these miracles and telling people to make an image to the beast and to worship that image. Just like Nebuchadnezzar made an image of himself and commanded all the earth to worship this image of him. He was granted the power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. So literally, he would create a statue, an image, and then give it life, and it would start doing things. I don't think that's what's meant here. I think it's more allegorical, obviously. But notice he uses this power, verse 16, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or in their foreheads. So they can't buy or sell unless you have this name of the beast or the number of his name. And so Satan has his mark, and his mark has to do with the breaking of God's commandments. He teaches them to break God's commandments by worshiping the beast. It has essentially to do with idol worship. Now let's drop down now to chapter 18 and verse 1. Go over to chapter 18 and verse 1. We find here that essentially iniquity or sin and iniquity is the mark of the beast, the breaking of God's commandments, very likely the fourth being the most notable. In Revelation chapter 18 and verse 1, after these things I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. So John sees this angel coming down, very, very bright angel. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, is fallen. So Babylon has fallen for the second time, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. And the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her delicacies. So all the earth, of course, becomes a part of this system. Down in verse 4, I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues." Another warning that you've only got a short time to be able to escape receiving the plagues that are coming on the earth. In a sense, the same subject that Zephaniah talked about. Verse 5, "For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities." So this woman and her mark involve sin and iniquity, something we are obviously to avoid because we have the seal of God, which is to depart from iniquity. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 1, a book that's written to a church that's going to be in distress, written probably in 66, 67 AD, about the coming destruction of Jerusalem and how that church would have no enduring city on the earth, but would have one enduring city in heaven, the heavenly Jerusalem or the Jerusalem above, and that they were to be prepared to leave because that city was going to be destroyed. Their city they had loved, worshipped in, was their home, was going to be no more. Hebrews chapter 1, he says, "God, who at various times and in various ways spoke in time past to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by his Son." Now, it's true that for many, many years, God spoke directly to people like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joshua, you know, many others, many of the prophets in the Old Testament, we have the Word of God came to them. So what Paul is saying is that, yeah, for many, many years, in times past and in various ways, God spoke to the prophets directly in one form or another. But in these last days, we have the words spoken by Jesus Christ. We have what's called the testimony of Jesus Christ. We have his words. And so Christ doesn't come down and speak to us on a one-on-one basis. He speaks to us through his word. Now, there's always people who think that God comes down and talks to them. They have sort of this special relationship. I don't know how many people I've visited over the years, primarily women, but some men, who received these special visits from some supernatural being on a regular basis and felt that we should tell them about it, or they should tell us about it. In most cases, we have to read them these two verses and say, well, you know, God doesn't do that now. And if you are hearing voices, it may not be really voices from God. It may be from some other source. I recall many, many years ago when I was a ministerial assistant to Mr. David Mills in Salem, we got this phone call from a lady, I think it was McMinnville area, and she wanted us to come baptize her that day. And we'd never known who she was before that. So we drove out to visit with her, and she told us very plainly that Jesus Christ had came and sat on her bed that night and the night before and had told her to get baptized and that she should call us to get baptized. So she called us, and we came out, and after she told us that, we said, well, we really don't think we want to baptize you today. We want you to, you know, read your Bible more, and here's some booklets to study. We want to make sure you fully comprehend the commitment and what you have to repent of. And she got really upset with us. And she says, you're not going to baptize me right now today? And we said, well, no. She says, well, you're defying God. And we said, well, we don't really think we're defying God. We hope he's merciful if we are, but we really don't think that it was Christ who came and sat on your bed last time. So there are people who are determined that that's the way God does things, even though the Bible is plain that he doesn't do that now, that he simply has the words written down for us, all that we need to know to attain his kingdom, and he's left us to live by faith, and he communicates with us through his spoken word that's been written down. A little bit farther, verse 5, he says, "To which of the angels did God ever say, 'You are my son, today I have begotten you'?" He's saying, you know, you're greater than an angel in potential. You have the potential to be God's son in his family. You are not just the potential of an angel. And then down a little bit farther in verse 8, to the son he says, "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of righteousness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated lawlessness." Almost a word-for-word description of the seal of God, that God says all they that know him have. He knows those that are his. They love righteousness and hated lawlessness. Therefore, God has anointed you with the oil of gladness more than your companions. Amazing that, you know, God said, look, you have more than all your companions, more than all those who are around you, because you have a promise to someday be a ruler and rule with Jesus Christ in his throne. And down in verse 1 of chapter 2, He says, "Therefore we must give the more earnest heed to the things that we have heard, lest we drift away." This group that was being written to might have some similarities to us today. They were a group that was going to be going through some very great tribulation. They had a window of opportunity when they could seek God while He may be found, when they could learn humility, when they could learn to be as righteous as possible with God's help, when they could learn to resist iniquity. But the clock was ticking. They didn't know when the Romans would come back. Certainly the Romans didn't know, but they came back pretty quickly. The danger was forgetting what they've heard. So Paul says, "Give earnest heed to the things that you've heard, lest you drift away." In verse 3, "How shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation?" Well, we hope to escape a lot of the evil things that come upon the earth. God promises His people, if we seek Him and have His seal, that He will grant us that. In the meantime, there's a window of opportunity to seek God, to learn righteousness, and to hope that we have the seal of God.